What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, we did a podcast, about 8, 10 months ago, dealing with the fact that millennials are having less sex. You remember that?
I do remember that. I thought you were just doing that to get the numbers up here.
Well,
but I guess it's true.
It is true. They're so busy on their handheld devices. Not to be confused with other handheld devices.
Well, you know, they're in no rush to get married. They don't seem to. They're not in a rush to drive cars. I mean, it's a different world out there.
For them. They're not financially ready either, unfortunately, because of all the debt overhang
that accompanies
them. But we do have declining fertility in America. And you and I, when we talked about this topic in advance, we said, oh, there's got to be just a couple of reasons. And it's going to be a simple thing for us to dissect, and we'll get a guest on. Because let's be honest, John, as a trend, when a society has fewer children.
Right. What's the United States going to look like in 20 years?
Exactly. It has major implications because the economy in America is built on young people building lives together.
Plus, we need them to pay our Social Security.
Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely.
Get to work.
And it does. It has an impact on Social Security, Medicare. I mean, everything else. But we thought, okay, it'll be easy to unpack this, right?
Right.
That's what we thought. And then all of a sudden, we got into a conversation about this with Lyman Stone from the American Enterprise Institute. And we found out that it was a lot more complicated. And there are many more hairs growing off of this thing than we thought.
Wow, that's true. I mean, you look at what goes on in the news with the Me Too moment and stuff. And really, you know, women have really been pushed to the forefront. And guys are really, you know, they're being left behind.
And women have their own lives, and they can have lives that are apart from, you know, actually having children and raising children that are really rich and rewarding. And this is one of the first generations, not the first, where that has been the case, where opportunities have opened up. So their life choices are much broader than we once thought, you know, for women.
I think it's great. I think it's kind of sad, though, too, in a way, you know? I mean, I think they're missing out.
Well, a lot of them are trying to have it all. And do it all. Yeah. And it's not easy. And so when you look at it, even if somebody today is thinking about having children, they're not thinking of having that family of four or five or six. It's one or two, maybe three. And that, of course, is having an impact on the fertility here in the United States. That all has economic consequences. It has social implications. So these are things that cannot be looked at in isolation.
That's true.
So we're looking at what is it that we need to do as a society to encourage people to have children. And if they're not going to have children, we've got a lot of decisions to make as a society about immigration, because we're going to need workers, John. We're going to need help, particularly for some of us who are a little bit older. I mean, you're not going to outsource home care.
No, but here's the problem with immigration is, you know, we got two different things going here. We got this illegal immigration, which is a problem, which we got to figure out how to handle. And then we got legal immigration. Are we doing that right? And our Congress is asleep at the wheel.
They absolutely are. And we will talk about that in another podcast. But in this podcast, we will look at the decline in this birth rate issue, not only, John, for women under 30, but in recent years, even women in their 30s have seen these falling birth rates. And then, of course, there are a lot of women who have delayed having children.
If you wait too long.
Well, thinking, that in their mid-30s, they will do it. And it becomes a little more, tremulous trying to do it at that stage of life.
Yeah, no, it's a tough situation here. And hopefully we got some good answers on our podcast for people out there.
Absolutely. So we're talking about love. We're talking about marriage. We're talking about children. We're talking about all of the impacts of these things on how we live our lives and how robust a future and a society America is going to be if it's really left to an aging population. We've seen that in other countries. We're not the only ones going through this at this moment in time, as you can imagine. No, Japan has been going through this for probably two decades.
I think Greece and some of those other countries, too, are very, very
Italy,
low.
Yeah, there are many others.
And they're struggling.
Lyman Stone has a real contextual sense of what these declining fertility rates mean in America and around the world. And he's going to share some incredible perspectives with you today on America Trends. With us on the line is Lyman Stone, a specialist in population change. And I find it fascinating that birth rates are declining in America. And it seems like this trend is one that we're going to see for a pretty long period of time. Does it look that way to you, Lyman?
It does look that way. There are many forces driving lower fertility rates, from delayed marriage to rising child care costs to increased demands for a two-earner household. And none of these are going away. These are all forces that are likely to remain for a long time. And so for that reason, we can't really expect general fertility to rise in the near future.
We have looked at many other countries over the recent period, Japan probably first among them, where they really have had a very low birth rate for many, many years, and now they have a very elderly population. What are the implications when a birth rate declines dramatically in a country? Because I don't think we've thought about that in the context of the United States. We've always thought of ourselves as a youth-oriented culture.
When the fertility rate in a country falls, at first, it can feel good. It seems like everybody has a little more pocket money, less pressure on their budget. It looks like there's a boom in personal consumption, you know, restaurants and movies and travel and what have you. But in the long run, say 25, 30 years after the fertility decline, what you see is that there's a diminishment in the supply of labor force growth. That is, that there's just fewer workers around, and with fewer workers, that means fewer tax revenues. But it's not just that. It turns out that a slower pace of labor force growth doesn't just have the static effect of lower tax revenues. It also results in essentially what we could say is lower per capita output. That it turns out that the economy is not a lump that you can just divide by the number of people in each generation. So if you shrink the generation size, it doesn't make each person who grows up in that generation richer. In fact, it makes them poorer. It turns out that slower labor force growth is associated and may in fact be causally related, if you believe the most recent literature, with higher inequality, lower labor share of national income, less entrepreneurship, less innovation, and of course higher tax burdens on the private sector to pay for exploding pension obligations.
And we share this lower birth rate with a lot of other industrialized nations. Is there a nation that's ahead of us in this declining curve that we might look to and say that's where America is going to be in 10, 15, 20 years?
Sure, there are a lot of places that are ahead of us. Historically, the United States has been a high fertility country. We've always sort of said that about ourselves, that, oh, you know, low fertility is a European problem. Americans have plenty of babies. Well, that's changing. As recently as 2006, we had one of the highest fertility rates in the developed world. Now, we're middle of the pack. But fertility rates are falling everywhere. Now, there are some countries that have been experiencing low fertility for a much longer time than us. Countries like Italy or Spain or Germany have all had lower fertility for a long time. Much of Eastern Europe has had low fertility for a long time. Much of East Asia has had lower fertility for a long time. And what we see in all of them is that there's a growing urgency that policymakers are waking up and realizing that in the next few decades, they're going to have a major economic and social problem on their hands, as there simply isn't a next generation there to pay for retirees and really to carry on the nation as a distinct concept.
How much of this is cultural, and because this has not been the American culture in terms of childbearing, we have valued it for a long period of time, and I wouldn't suggest necessarily that we don't today, but many of the barriers seem to be more economic than whether we really want to raise a family or have a family.
The cultural side is important. Particularly in recent years, because what we've seen is that historically, fertility behaves fairly cyclically. That is, in good times, fertility rises, in bad times, it falls. But what we've seen in recent years is that even as the economy is making serious headway, fertility is still falling. So it can't just be that families are under great strain that they weren't in the past. It has to be that there's something else going on. So there are a lot of cultural changes here. There's delayed marriage. There is the view of children as sort of a capstone achievement instead of a God-given blessing or perhaps a family requirement. But one cultural change that we actually don't see, which is quite interesting, Americans are not saying that they want fewer children. We have a lot of surveys on this, and across those surveys, it looks like the amount of children that Americans desire to have, in particularly reproductive age women, is actually about stable. We haven't seen a sharp fall off in it. So we're seeing a decline in fertility, but without any simultaneous economic collapse and without any simultaneous cultural shift against children in principle. Rather, we're seeing an increase in barriers to childbearing, and we're seeing what we might call a culture with poor foresight. That is a culture that says, well, I want to have three kids, but I don't want to get married until I'm 30 after I've paid off my student loans and have a good job. Well, it turns out those two things are hard to both have. And we've done a very poor job explaining that to my generation. That, you know, when you go to college, you actually don't have 15 years of great fertility. That most people don't. Most people, your fertility is going to start declining in your late 20s or early 30s. And when it begins to decline, it can decline quickly. We don't tell people that when you get married, it actually has a very large impact on how many children you ultimately have. We don't really talk about this. When a high school guidance counselor talks about students' plan for their future, it's all about their career, it's all about financial aid, it's all about their student loans, it's all about college quality, and nobody talks about expected family life. And I think that's really a major shortfall in how we educate young people about their future.
Is there a sense that you can reverse a lot of the age limitations relative to childbearing because of all the technology that we read about and the various solutions and various fertility efforts that are underway scientifically? I know in your report you suggest that that's not going to be the answer ultimately to this issue.
So reproductive technology can help a lot of women have children. It does a lot to assist that. The problem is what we're seeing is not some explosion in biological infertility. That's not what's happening. What's happening is an explosion of what we might call sociological infertility. That is, it's not that people can't biologically have children. It's that there are other things going on that prevent them from doing it right now. And while assisted reproduction can, of course, help older women have children, there's an upper limit on that. You know, in vitro fertilization success rates decline precipitously as a woman ages, just like conventional conception rates decline. The usefulness of technologies like Clomid or artificial insemination or therapeutic HSGs declines with age. There's nothing, even freezing eggs. It turns out that frozen eggs implanted in an older mother still, well, it depends on how old. You know, very young mothers have major miscarriage risk as well. But older moms, so late 30s and into their 40s, also have substantial miscarriage risks associated with, say, implanting a frozen egg. So reproductive technology can do a lot, but there's a limit to what it can do. In many countries, aggressively subsidize reproductive technology as part of a pronatal strategy. The most famous example of this is Israel. And yet, even though the average woman in Israel has something like 10 times as many IVF cycles as the average American woman, it only accounts for a single-digit percentage of births. Something like 90% of Israel's higher fertility has nothing to do with more aggressive use of assisted reproductive technology. So I think that there is a place for a technological shift in fertility in the future, but it's simply too small, too expensive, has too many limitations for it to really be the macro driver of fertility trends.
Lyman Stone is with us, and he's with the American Enterprise Institute, and they have a report on declining fertility in America. Some say that the greater availability of contraception plays into all of this, and there's a decline in teen pregnancies. So there are certain positive aspects to this, but do you attribute any of what we're seeing to those factors?
Yes, of course. I mean, one big change we've seen is the rise in long-acting reversible contraceptives, so LARCs, you know, implants and things like that. And they're far more effective at helping women actually practically prevent pregnancy. So that's certainly part of the story. But what I want to emphasize is a recent study, the National Bureau of Economic Research, actually tried to tease this question out. How much of the decline in fertility in the last 10 years is driven by a decline in unintended births? You know, if it's all a decline in unintended births, well, that doesn't seem so bad. That might just be American women having fertility that's closer to what they want. But it turns out the decline in unintended births accounts for considerably less than half of the total decline in births. My recollection is that it's something around a third. So you can say, sure, a third of the decline might be driven by a decline in unintended births. That's good news. But most of it isn't about a decline in unintended births. Most of this is not driven by women having better control of their fertility. In fact, it's the opposite. All too often, we talk about their right to choose, the right to have bodily autonomy, the right to control fertility, and we act like the only relevant question there is preventing childbirth, as if the only thing that a woman could possibly want is to not have a baby. But it turns out, and I actually just wrote a study on this, if you look at fertility desires around the world, and you compare them to fertility achievement around the world, that the number of missing babies, that is, babies that women say they would like to have but are unlikely to actually have in reality, greatly exceeds the number of unintended babies. That in fact, while an unintended baby may have more costs on a woman's life than a missing baby, just in pure numbers, missing babies are more common.
Wait, it's explain that concept of missing babies.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, we can ask a woman, how many children would you like to have? And then we look at how many children she actually ends up having over the course of her life. So in almost every developed country in the world, the number of children that women want to have is greater than the number of children they ultimately do have, which means you get this gap, these missing babies. In fact, even in many poor countries, even in high fertility countries like Nigeria and Niger, it turns out that desired childbearing is higher than achieved childbearing. Now, there are some countries where desired childbearing is higher than achieved childbearing, like India or much of South and East Africa. But the global norm is fertility undershooting. Now, this is a new thing. Up until about 1999, the global norm was fertility overshooting, women having more kids than they wanted to have. But we've seen a rapid change in that increasingly we're living in a world where the defining fertility problem facing human reproduction is not too many kids, but too few. And this is a seismic change. Family planning associations, demographers, policymakers, this is not a world they ever prepared for. It was an assumption that excessive fertility would always be the norm. But it turns out that problem has largely been dealt with.
What is the reason for that disparity between the number of children that a woman, let's say, wants versus the number that she ultimately has? Is it the expectation today that if you are going to survive financially, both of you have to be in the workplace and therefore women want to be in the workplace, so they give up one thing for another? What's going on here, as best we can tell?
Well, it is actually not because more women want to be in the workplace. In fact, majorities of employed moms continue to report that they would like to be full-time homemakers. So it's not that. Women's reported desire to work has risen some, but actually women's reported desire to work, it has some predictive value in explaining how many women return to work, but it's imperfect. So there is perhaps some of that. But the main driver is what I called that problem of foresight, that when a woman is 16, we tell her that what her life is going to look like is that she's going to get a college degree, maybe an advanced degree. She's going to have two or three kids. She's going to get married in her late 20s. She's going to meet her grandkids. She's going to see her children get married. She's going to have this full life that has everything. Practically speaking, that is not what most people experience. Women systematically overestimate. There's actually a very interesting study on this maybe a year and a half ago. women systematically, and I should actually say men as well, systematically overestimate the number of children that they are likely to have over the course of their life. And they also systematically overestimate how many years of their life they are likely to spend employed. It's not that we're helping women achieve one side of this equation, and so they're trading off the other side. Practically speaking, what we're seeing, it's not that women aren't getting it all, it's they're not getting either of it. They're not experiencing the family life they expected, and they're not experiencing the work life they expected. I don't think this is because they necessarily have unrealistic expectations. I think that it is because society doesn't actually talk to women about how to achieve those expectations. We talk a lot about how to get a job. We don't talk a lot about how to get a family.
And as you look at that, I mean, what's the reason that either we're telling ourselves a story that isn't accurate, or we're being told a story at a very young age and expectations are being set at that point? What is that for? I mean, what is it, if we're getting it wrong, why are we getting it wrong?
Some of it is simple ignorance. There have been studies done on fertility knowledge, for example. You take young women and you give them a quiz about biological fertility. You just ask, you know, things like, at what age does the typical woman's fertility begin to decline? Questions like this. And it turns out most people's beliefs about biological fertility are slightly more educated than believing a stork brings babies. That is, that people really don't understand how biological fertility works. So the result is that people have these erroneous beliefs that if they start trying to have children when they're 30, that their likelihood of achieving their fertility intention, their fertility desires, remains high, when in fact it's quite low. We simply have poor family education to some extent. And research shows that when you educate people about this, there's not been long-term longitudinal research on this, but there's been short-term stuff. When you educate women on this, it tends to alter their expressed fertility preferences. That they start to say, oh gosh, I think I do want to have children a year or two earlier. I think I do want to get married a year or two earlier. That these types of beliefs are partly informed just by bad education. I think another part of it is, there was an interesting article recently by Derek Thompson at The Atlantic. He described a phenomenon called workism. That is, America's leading religion, the religion of work, the worship of work as the highest value thing in life. And I think we see that a lot, especially with educated young people. And so I think we've convinced a lot of people that there is no dignity to being a parent, that it is expensive, miserable, and messy, and that there's the trade-off is sort of warm fuzzies about having a child. When I would say, in fact, the trade-off is being part of the millennial-long project of human civilization.
We are not making enough babies to replace ourselves in the U.S. today. Do you see that continuing? And how long have we been in this trough as it relates to our total fertility rate?
Well, as recently as 2006 and 2007, we had above replacement fertility rates. This is recent. We also see that this decline is shared by a lot of developed countries. So we see declines in the Nordics. We see declines in France. We see declines in the antipodean countries in the Pacific. We see declines in Southern Europe, in Northern Europe, in Western Europe. This is a widely shared phenomenon. It's basically the last 10 years. We are now at lowest fertility ever in the United States. And there's not yet really a bottom in sight.
When we look at it, I know that a lot of our economic system, and you talked about some of the other downsides of this, is really built on young adults having a family, buying a home, and becoming consumers, because our economy is built on a consumer model, if you will. How much of the downside, though, of people deciding not to have children or underestimating, how many they're going to ultimately have against what they imagined they wanted to have when they run up against the cost of their debt service for their costs of student loans, mm-hmm. the higher cost of child care, and they start really doing an analysis and saying, just financially, this is going to be so difficult. Emotionally, it may be difficult not having a child, but financially, it's mm-hmm. going to be difficult having more than X.
Yeah, that's absolutely a big problem. The cost of childcare has risen steadily for decades. Now, as a share of income, it's a lot more stable. That is, children are not that much more expensive as a share of average income than they were in the past. They are more expensive as a share of median income, but not so much average, so that's a product of inequality. So there's an sense in which you could say inequality may be lowering fertility to some extent. We do see in surveys that the reasons people report for not having children are wide-ranging, but they do include financial factors. Student loans, cost of childcare, things like that. There is a bit of a problem with that story, however. First of all, the amount of money being paid by families with student loan, actually the total loan debt service payments on student loans have actually not risen in recent years. That is, sure, the balance of student loans has risen, but interest rates have been relatively low. The total debt service payments on student loans are not anomalously high compared to the last 20 or 30 years or so. So that's one problem with the student loan story. Now, of course, student loans are unique in that if you don't pay them, you can't default out of them. And they feel very prevalent for that reason. They have comparatively high payments compared to the balance. There are reasons to think student loans may matter, and I do think they matter, both through the direct fertility channel and by discouraging marriage. But it's important not to overstate that too much. Now, high housing costs are a big issue. What we see is that there are fewer and fewer family-style houses being built in America. That's two- and three-bedroom starter homes. What we see is that housing prices in cities with jobs are rising dramatically. In fact, housing prices generally are going up. And what we see is that in places where housing prices have risen more, especially places where rent has risen more, that fertility has declined the fastest. So there's definitely a sense in which family budgets matter here. High costs do discourage fertility. But how we respond to that is a bit tricky. So childcare costs are expensive. So many people have proposed free daycare as a solution. You might think, well, if childcare costs are expensive, then free daycare must boost births. It's not clear that this is likely to happen because daycare doesn't just reduce childcare costs. It also enables, it specifically incentivizes parents to work, right? Because if you stay home, you don't get the benefit of free daycare. So it incentivizes work, which, again, is great for the economy. But the important thing to understand here is that being in the labor force reduces particularly a woman's odds of having children. So you get this trade-off where daycare makes the budget easier, but it doesn't actually free up time because that time is now used for market-based work. That's why if you really want to ease family budgets, the better way to do it is simply to ease family budgets. Simply have a direct per-child cash transfer. That method doesn't discriminate between families with stay-at-home parents. It eases family budgets, and it doesn't mess with people's work choices.
Is this being done in certain countries? And do you think American policymakers have awoken to this issue and its long-term implications for the country?
Yes, this is done in many countries. We see it in Canada. We see it in the Nordics. We see it in Germany. We see it in France. We see it in much of East Asia. It's a go-to response that countries have had. And what we see is that it does increase fertility, at least in the short run. Long run is a bit more complicated, but certainly in the short run, it increases fertility. So it works, so to speak. Now, it's expensive. It is quite expensive. However, it doesn't just increase fertility. It dramatically lowers child poverty. So these are actually two wonderful simultaneous goals, that you reduce child poverty and you get more children. This is really a beautiful synergy. So we do see this in other countries. We do see that it has a pronatal effect. And there are U.S. policymakers interested in it. The push to increase the child tax credit by Marco Rubio, Mike Lee, and Tim Scott in the recent tax reform had many motivations, but it would be wrong to say that pronatalism was not part of the calculation. It was. This is something on many U.S. policymakers' minds. There are a lot of people interested in it, and I think that any political party that considers itself friendly to families should be working this direction. We should be thinking about how to make it possible for middle-class people to have families, to have a stable household budget with kids, with two or three kids, not just one. I think this is an important goal. In fact, it's probably a more important policy goal than trying to just artificially juice female labor force participation.
By the way, John has a question for you, Lyman. Yes, John.
Well, you know, I've seen on TV where the world population is so big, the planet, you know, you get this, the planet is not going to be able to take it anymore. And you hear this news and you sort of wonder how this is affecting, you know, the kids' minds too. What do you
think?
I mean,
you see that you've seen that much more recently with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She recently said that, you know, when you think about the climate impact, should you really have kids? Is it okay to have kids?
Exactly.
Cause this controversy. And we do see that there is a substantial minority of women who knows how decisive it is, but this concern exists for them. And what I would say is that, on the one hand, I understand it. If you're thinking long-term, and having children means thinking long-term, you care about long-term issues. And there's no long-term issue that looms more prominent than the solvency of long-term obligations and climate change. These are the two defining issues for people's perceptions about what the future is going to be like for their children. Will the government be able to pay its basic bills and provide basic services? And will climate change cause an apocalypse? And what I usually say to these people is, well, many things. One is, when you actually do the hard math, when you take the consensus climate change models out of the IPCC and you plug in different fertility scenarios to them, it turns out it just doesn't matter. That is, that plausible changes in fertility do not have a large enough impact in a near enough time frame to substantially alter global emissions or the path of warming. So I understand the concern, and if it were mathematically correct, that would be very interesting. But it just turns out to be incorrect math. Population actually has a very small part to play in global warming. And the reason for that is because if you don't have a child, it's not like you just sit on that money and cackle madly about how much money you have. You spend it. You spend it on a vacation. You fly to Italy. You spend it on healthcare. You spend it on video games. You spend it on any number of things. And those things have a carbon footprint.
Oh, absolutely.
A larger carbon footprint.
Lyman, I think perhaps some of the people who are, you know, deciding that they don't want to have a child, number one, if they think that the message is there are already too many of us on the planet, or that it's going to be uninhabitable going forward, why bring someone into this world? But these are all really interesting and complicated issues. But you have walked us through this declining fertility in so many different ways that I don't think many people have considered all of the various implications. And I want to thank you for that. From the American Enterprise Institute on America Trends today, Lyman Stone. Lyman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.